From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
Ich habe ein Pianola zu Hause in meinem Salon. Ich bin die fesche Lola, ich lieb ein Jedermann. Doch an mein Pianola, da lass ich keinen ran.
An exhibit called Glitter and Doom, German Portraits from the 1920s, is currently on view at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It presents an insider's view of the turbulent but creative period between the two world wars by 10 of the leading artists of the time. I'm pleased to welcome the show's curator, Sabina Riewoldt, to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
Philippe de Montebello, the museum's director, says that this show is the first anywhere to focus on the portraiture of the Weimar period. Now, why do you think it hasn't been done before?
I don't know why it hasn't done before. It should have been done in Germany, but I think the Germans don't like to do any exhibitions that deal with the 1920s or the Weimar Republic because they see the Weimar Republic already as a springboard to Nazism and Hitler. And that is why they are wary. That is why also we had difficulty getting German sponsors for the exhibition, because I think anything related to Weimar, people keep their hands off.
But this is the opposite of everything that Hitler was about. In fact, he put together exhibits of decadent art, which included all of these artists.
He put together an exhibition called Degenerate Art.
Degenerate Art.
These artists were all declared degenerate when Hitler came to power in 1933. Their works were confiscated and most often destroyed.
This is also a period that has been celebrated in literature by Christopher Isherwood, the Berlin Stories, later made into the hit play and film Cabaret. But I get a feeling that that almost cleaned up the scene. Looking at some of these paintings, it seems like it was even more decadent than Cabaret suggested.
Well, Cabaret, in a way, is later than my exhibition. Cabaret, he came to Berlin in 1929, I think. My exhibition starts with 1920, directly after World War I, when the time really was one of political upheaval, high inflation. The streets were full of cripples and prostitutes, and I wanted to focus really on years that nobody had focused. I wanted to retell the story of the years right after World War I via the portraits, and that is why I chose very carefully. I wanted the professional classes to be represented, lawyers, doctors, art dealers, poets and writers, but also the demi-monde, cocaine addicts, performers, prostitutes.
And the painters themselves.
And the painters themselves in their self-portraits.
And some of them are well-known, Max Beckmann, Otto Dix, George Gross, but others, at least not in this country, Heinrich Maria Davringhausen, Ludwig Meidner, Gert Heinrich Wolheim, were they famous at the time?
They were not famous at the time, and I was lucky to get Davringhausen's best portrait. It's a portrait of a, what would you call it, a profiteer, a man who sits in his office with just the accessories that today's Wall Street shark could identify with, a telephone, a glass of cognac, a fat cigar, and he outside of the window you see skyscrapers.
Now, would he have commissioned that painting? Because that painting is quite damning, as are many of them.
No, it is. Nobody posed for that picture. Davringhausen painted it from his imagination, because also at that time in 1921, one did not have skyscrapers that were as high. So this is a make-believe profiteer painted at the heights of when the inflation started to climb.
But many of these are portraits of real people. And you wonder whether, if they sat for them, whether they knew the way they were going to turn out.
These people who sat, you would ask yourself, were they crazy? Why did they sit for something like this? Because Dix, in a way, reduced them to a type and made them very ugly. So self-respecting, self-important people would never sit for a portrait by Dix. Marlene Dietrich would have gone to a photographer where she could have controlled the light and how she looked, or Albert Einstein would have gone to a society portraitist. These were people who had a lot of humor, who were patrons of the artist, who respected him, often were involved, even when they were doctors, who were art collectors, often had galleries. And they did not own these pictures. Dix asked them to paint them because he wanted a specific type. And Dix kept these pictures.
And there, could you tell us about his portraits of the dancer Anita Berber or the journalist Sylvia Van Harten? Were they well known at the time?
No. Well, yes and no. Sylvia Van Harten was not known. She was a minor journalist that Dix picked up in a literary cafe at night in Berlin. She was ungainly, had a monocle. She was a lesbian. And so he followed her out, and he grabbed her, and he said, "I have to paint you." She said, "Why? I have buck teeth, I have a long chin, and I'm very ugly." He said, "Because you represent our era." And so we know. Why do we know about it? Because she was a journalist, and she was not known, and she wrote about it in 2-3 articles. She was unknown, and she, in a way, knew that Dix was known already, and for her it was a compliment to be asked, and she was not vain. How could she, being so ugly? Anita Berber was a famous performer and dancer, more famous than Marlene Dietrich at the time. And Anita Berber is depicted in one of her notorious dances called Morphine, Morphium. She was a cocaine addict herself, and her whole career spent only 8 or 9 years, and she died very young, and the picture shows her, although she's only 26, already corroded by her cocaine addict and the bottle of cognac she drank every day.
And some of these pictures really can be hard to look at. Three wenches. It has three of the most unappetizing women ever to ply the trade of prostitution. He has a watercolor, The Dream of the Sadist, that depicts four women being tortured. Was he a misogynist?
Not at all. Not at all. It's a beautiful watercolor with luscious watercolor, and it is called The Dream of the Sadist. It's, you see, in a way, he removed himself from it, and it is a fantasy. And I got a very irate letter from a lawyer who took issue with me that on my wall label I only talked about lesbian clubs in Berlin that soared, instead of writing a little dissertation on the wall label to go into the minutiae of lesbians and homosexuals in the Weimar Republic, which, of course, you cannot do on a wall label.
Because they were out at that time?
Well, you see, there was the, how do you call these laws in 1918 that were done away with? Mm-hmm. Whatever, there were laws. So Berlin became the Babel of the world. You had nightclubs catering to every sexual taste. That is also why Christopher Isherwood went to Berlin. Many people went to Berlin because there was a nightlife that they couldn't have anywhere else. So you had cabarets, you had theater, you had luge clubs, you had all sorts of things. So people came from all over Europe. Berlin was the third largest metropolis then.
But some people would associate that kind of decadence with what was to follow and the reaction to it as something that would have led to a dictatorship, a totalitarian
situation. That is
not
so. That is not so, because what followed really had to do with Germany had for the first time a republic. They had no so-called instruction sheet how to have a republic. They had too many parties from the right to the left to the center. Their politicians were inexperienced. They were all jockeying for power. And they did not have anybody really to make the Weimar Republic, although they were trying to succeed. It had nothing to do with the nightlife.
All of these painters were part of a movement called the Neue Sachlichkeit, the new objectivity, and especially a branch called Verism. Is this something that is totally German?
It is totally German. And of course, although the Germans try to be so very correct and meticulous, when you say new objectivity, none of these portraits you will see are objective. They are not. They are rather
But some are hyper-realist.
Hyper-realist, but satirical. And verism is supposed to be the left branch of that new objectivity, to be more truthful, to be more cynical, to be much tougher, because another wing, the right wing, was a magical realism which idolized, where you had landscapes, mother with children, etc. This was the verism were active in the big cities as Dresden and Hamburg and Berlin.
Even though there was this this openness and license, one of the paintings, Christian Schad's Two Girls, wasn't exhibited publicly until 1977, although it was painted in 1928. Because of its sexual content?
Well, it shows two lesbians doing what lesbians do, and one is sitting in the foreground playing with herself. It is a picture that, as subject matter, is not new in art. You have erotic drawings, but they do it in small formats. This is a big painting, and I know it is the first painting in which something like this is graphically depicted. It's a beautiful painting, and of course it could not have been exhibited before, and also it was not reproduced in its entirety until the mid-70s. We have a label, we have a little sign when you come into the exhibition that warns parents to please not take their children into the exhibition and to advise for parental discretion. But of course, I see lots of mothers with their little toddlers in pushcart, and of course the little toddlers don't know what they're seeing.
They have no idea. Why do you think Dixon Schad painted so many of these people in the margins of society? Were they making some kind of a statement about...
They were making a statement about the society that was unhinged after World War I.
And then you have George Grosz's paintings, which are shocking in a very different way. He's very political. Interesting that when he came to the United States and moved to New York, he became totally apolitical.
He did. It is very interesting. You see, Dix was not very politically inclined. Neither was Schad, who set out the war in Switzerland. He was the only one of these artists who did not fight in the war and came back full of anger and hate. But Grosz fought in the war, not very long, because he then had a nervous breakdown himself. He was a staunch communist and a leftist, and he felt that the Germans were absolutely incompetent, especially the politicians. And in his large paintings, he takes those politicians to task, and he really adopting a style that might be sort of the Grand Guignol, which is very cartoonish and very obvious. He, in a way, takes to task the politicians, the corrupt business people, the corrupt armament industry, etc. Interesting in his drawings, for those that he had admiration for and love, he adopts an Unger-like pencil for his mother-in-law, for war cripples, for blind people. There he is very tender and different.
But these large paintings are almost like political cartoons made into fine art.
That is correct, yes.
And there's one, in fact, where he called The Eclipse of the Sun about Germany's president, Paul von Hindenburg, showing him to be a red-faced buffoon controlled by arms manufacturers. Later we had, in this country, we had Jack Levine, I guess, who was inspired by that kind of art.
That Hindenburg was the World War I hero and an aristocrat, so all the institutions in Germany who didn't embrace the socialist government, because the Germans were terrified of them, rallied around this World War I hero. And, you know, the ministries, the academies, the church, everybody rallied around him. And so he depicts this battle-like hunk who looks gross on a table with headless ministers, and a fat industrialist, corrupt, whispers in his ear. So he shows that Hindenburg was a puppet himself.
Are these works valued highly these days?
They're very much valued. For example, that large painting with which I end the exhibition as a sort of coda to show how prescient Gross was. It was the midterm of the Weimar Republic, only 1926, when everybody thought things look up. Gross brought that painting with him, and it ended up with a electrician in the 1960s who bought it from a colleague who had inherited it for $150. The man had it then for 10 years, didn't know it was a Gross, rolled it like a carpet on his floor to show his friends after dinner. Everybody thought, what an ugly picture. He then, somebody told him it is a Gross. He tried to sell it, and he did sell it to the Heckscher Museum in the 60s for $15,000, and he had to give the agent $5,000. So the poor man got only 10. That picture is now worth about $20 million. And I invited this nice electrician to the opening. And I said, well, what do you say now, seeing your painting here in this exhibition at the Met? Aren't you sad you haven't hung on to it? No, he said, I'm not.
Where did you get most of these? Are these from private collections?
Most of them are from German museums. There are very few from private collections. These are pictures now that are in German museums, and I had a tough time to get the paintings because they are now so famous, and they're on wood, and the German museums behaved as if I wanted their Mona Lisa. So to some cities I had to go 4, 5, 6 times to make these museum people friends.
And that's why it took you 4 years to put this show together.
Yes.
And it only runs now until February 19th. Is this it? Just the Metropolitan
Museum?
This is
it, because I hardly got the pictures for us. And there was a museum in Munich. They wanted it as a second station, but I couldn't get these German museums to sort of prolong their loan for another 3 months, although most of these pictures go back to Germany. It's a pity. It should live on.
So you have until February 19th to see Glitter and Doom, German Portraits from the 1920s, although you can get a taste of the show by going to our website at wnyc.org, where we have a slideshow. My great thanks to the curator of the exhibit, Sabina Riewoldt, for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Veronica, 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 der Letz ist da. Veronica, der Letz ist da. Die Mädchen singen tralala. Die ganze Welt ist wie verhext. Veronica, der Spargel will. Ach du Veronica, die Welt ist grün. Du lass uns sing, die Welle zieht. Sogar der Großpapa.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.